So it's a pleasure to be here, especially among all these friendly faces and this friendly weather. To come from London to this has been a beautiful surprise for me. So I feel that I always need to start my talks with a kind of apology for my age, because often people turn up these talks and expect someone much older and wiser than myself. I'm afraid he couldn't be here tonight, so I came instead. My specialist subject is lucid dreaming, which today I'm going to touch on, but I'm actually going to focus on something much more specific, which is shadow integration and assimilation of nightmare aspects through lucid dreaming. Although I just start this with an overview of lucid dreaming for those of you who don't know. So the definition of a lucid dream is a dream in which the dreamer is actively aware of the fact that they are dreaming as the dream is occurring. So a lucid dream is not just a very vivid dream. It's not a prophetic dream. It's not a kind of out-of-body astral experience or anything like that. It is a dream in which part of the brain consciously switches back on and becomes self-reflexive, aware of the self. So people have known about lucid dreaming for thousands of years. The Tibetan Buddhists have been at it, dream yoga, for at least 1,000 years. You go way back into early Christianity, St. Augustine. You can go back to some early Muslim texts as well. And we get references to dreams in which the dreamer is aware of the fact that they're dreaming. But it wasn't until the early 80s that lucid dreaming was actually proved as a verifiable phenomenon of REM sleep. Up to then, it had all been subjective reports. But there's a guy called Stephen LaBerge, who's a name that you'll hear again and again if you get into lucid dreaming. He's the kind of the godfather of lucid dreaming, quite a controversial character nowadays, actually. But in 1977, he had just finished his degree at Stanford University in mathematics, which is actually very relevant, because it took a mathematician to come up with the data that would convince the scientific community. So after his mathematics degree, he did a PhD in psychophysiology. And the hypothesis of his PhD was to prove once and for all that lucid dreaming was a verifiable phenomenon of REM sleep. So what he needed to do was to prove that these reports of lucid dreaming were happening during REM and not during micro-awakenings, which is what a lot of the scientists at the time accepted. In fact, the scientific community in the late 70s, early 80s believed lucid dreaming to be, and I quote, a paradoxical impossibility. It was up there with flying saucers and telekinesis. There was no way it's for real. So Stephen LaBerge realized he needs to make sure people are in REM sleep. So there are three prerequisites for REM sleep. One is muscle paralysis. That's what prevents us acting out our dreams. Because neurologically, the exact same processes happen in dream activity as in waking activity. So if that muscle paralysis wasn't in place, we would act out our dreams. Because physiologically, that dreaming action is happening. The neurons are firing in exactly the same way. So muscle paralysis. The other thing was sensory blockade, which is that the senses are blocked from outside information. And the other was cortical activation, which means the brain is active. Because during REM sleep, the brain is actually as active or even sometimes more active than it is during waking. And this confused evolutionary biologists. They couldn't work out. It was such a waste of energy, it seemed. But as Dion touched on, there's definitely a reason for dreaming. So he hooked up people to EEG machines, which is kind of like a brain scanner, machines that scan their eyes for rapid eye movement, and machines that hooked up to their major muscle groups to check they're paralyzed. And he realized that he needed to send a signal from the lucid dream state to the waking world, which could then be corroborated. So there are two parts of the humans, well, all systems, that aren't paralyzed during REM sleep. One is the eyes. The eyes are moving, rapid eye movement. And in fact, the eyes often correspond to what you're dreaming about. So if you were dreaming about a table tennis match and someone was watching your eyes, you would see the eyeballs flick like that. And in fact, it was exactly that dream report that led Stephen LaBerge to this. So what he realized he needed to do was to give his lucid dreamers, and in fact, he was the first subject they tried it on, a highly randomized and prearranged set of eye signals, like, you know, 16 looks up, 2 looks down, 1 look left, 14 looks right, which could be given in the waking state, then recalled once the subject was lucid, and replayed. That data could then be cross-referred against the data collected by the EEG machine, and that would prove that an instruction could be taken into the waking state, the conscious mind would wake up, but the body is still asleep, and act out that instruction. So they did this, and they proved lucid dreaming. So Stephen LaBerge, as a mathematician, he gets all his graphs, he does it again and again and again, double-blind testing, very solid research, sends it off to Nature and Science, which one's a UK publication, one's an American publication. They're the two top, still really, the top scientific journals of the time. Both Nature and Science wrote back to him and said, although we accept the validity of your reports, we will not be publishing your data. It was just too far out. Neither of them wanted to touch it. So eventually he managed to get his findings published in a small psychology journal in the UK. And then he gave a speech at a big sleep and dream conference. And then in 82, 83, that was when it really hit and lucid dreaming was proved. It was an accepted phenomenon of REM sleep. So that makes it a very young form of dreaming for the scientific community anyway. Of course, lucid dreaming has been going on for thousands of years. But it's only had a couple of decades of research into it. But one of the first things that LaBerge did, because of course he received a whole load of money, Stanford were right behind him, they had the Stanford mark on it. One of the first things he did was that he proved that neurologically speaking, the dreaming mind in a lucid dream cannot and does not differentiate between waking and dreaming experience. Now this opens up huge capacity for healing. I'm sorry to use that word, it's very new agey, I wish there was another one to use. But if you hear my explanation, you'll see why I use it. He worked out that if we could spend our lucid dreams, and of course in a lucid dream you can actively and volitionally influence the dreamscape at will, if we could use our lucid dreams to actively seek out positive and beneficial frames of mind, engaging in positive, compassionate action in the dream state, then kind of serotonin release and exactly the same neurological processes were happening as they would do in the waking state. So when we woke up, we would feel the benefit of those positive mind states that we were cultivating in the dream. Another more specific example of this, I was giving the same teaching a few months ago in the UK, and there was a lady who was on the weekend course, and she suffers from ME, kind of chronic fatigue. And she said, I use lucid dreaming for healing. And I said, how? And she went, I use it to do all the things I can't do anymore because of my illness. And she had this beautiful description of how she uses her lucid dreams to go horse riding, to go jogging, to go dancing. And I thought, you know what? That's a better example of healing than anything I've come across. So it's not only it's not only physiological healing, but also psychological healing as well. And it's one of those methods of healing that I want to discuss now. Because nightmares, and to further that, shadow integration, is something which is very, very accessible through the lucid dream state. So nightmares usually occur in REM sleep, and they're very often narrative. They're narrative-based scenarios in which we're either fighting or fleeing from terrifying dream characters or dream scenarios. Quite different from night terrors, which usually happen in delta wave sleep. So nightmares can come for various reasons, post-traumatic stress, illness, or sometimes the treatment of illness, actually. A lot of side effects of drugs can lead to nightmares. And it seems that there is an evolutionary point to nightmares, in that the dream system produces simulations that are realistic rehearsals of threatening events in terms of perception and behavior, allowing humans to rehearse and refine their fight or flight mechanism. And also, from a brain level, they're used to maintain the limbic systems of the brain, which are the control centers for fear and memory, which in the waking state aid our survival. So it seems that every now and again, the brain will give us a nightmare, not due to post-traumatic stress, not due to any kind of medication we're taking or fears that we have, but just as little MOT for the mind, just to check how we would act in that situation of being chased, of fleeing, of attacking, the fight or flight. Now, how does this apply to lucid dreaming? Well, nightmares apply to lucid dreaming because research have shown that over a third of all lucid dreams are preceded by feelings of fear, anxiety, or full-blown nightmares. Has anyone ever had a nightmare in which they knew it was a nightmare? Yeah? Usually you get a much greater response with that than you do if you said, who's had a lucid dream? But in fact, a nightmare in which you knew that it was a nightmare is a lucid dream. And a majority of lucid dreams, or at least a third, start by those feelings of fear and anxiety. So nightmares for the lucid dreamer are a great blessing. Now, why is this? Why does fear and anxiety precede lucid dreams? Well, to understand that, we first got to understand the purpose of fear and anxiety in the waking state. So what happens when we get scared? Now, the biological purpose of fear is to make us scan our surroundings more carefully by boosting our physical senses, increasing cerebral blood flow, that's blood flow to the brain. All of this allowing us to become more aware of the potential threat. So right now, if someone ran in with a gun, we would all do this. Our senses, we become ready. Our eyes become more open. Our ears become more attuned. Now, if you apply that to the dream state, it's that boosting of awareness, boosting of reflective consciousness that can tip us onto the lucidity spectrum. And that's why so often it's through nightmares that we have our first experience of lucidity. Now, there's some interesting research that came from Erasmus University in Rotterdam in 2009 that showed that fear enhances our ability to identify coarse-grained features in preference to fine details. Because it seems that when someone's running towards you with an axe, you don't care whether they've got wrinkles. You care about their major movements, where the axe is moving to, where you're going to get attacked. So if you apply that to the lucid dream state, we can see that most of the time when we're in non-lucid dreams, it's because we're sucked into hyper-association, which is when if we're dreaming about the flower, dreaming about a flower, for example, we become sucked into the flower. We hyper-associate with the flower and associate ourselves with that flower. Now, when we feel fear in the dream, our focus will be pulled away from the flower and into the larger dreamscape. And if our focus gets pulled into the larger dreamscape, there'll be much more opportunities for us to realize that it's a dream. Because dreams are full of things called dream signs, which is any bizarre anomaly by which you can tell if you're dreaming. Usually full of thousands of dream signs. And one of the first things we do, and if you're into learning how to lucid dream, then we have a workshop tomorrow which you'll be learning all these techniques, is to note your dream signs. Because once you note your dream anomalies, some of which are recurrent, you can then learn to say, the next time I see a talking dog, or whatever your dream sign is, I will remember to recognize that I'm dreaming. So whatever way you look at it, nightmares can lead to lucidity, which make nightmares a great blessing for the lucid dreamer. And in fact, fundamentally usurp our negative perception of nightmares just by knowing it. Now, when lucid dreaming first came onto the scene, there are a lot of therapists who said, oh, we can use lucid dreaming to treat nightmares. And there was a little bit of backing behind this, and then it went. They poo-pooed the idea. They said, this is ridiculous. You know, there are other ways to treat nightmares, not through lucid dreaming. Now, at the end of 2009, something great happened at the University of Milan. A load of doctors, dream researchers, and psychologists got together. And they concluded that people suffering from nightmares have the potential to be treated by training to dream lucidly. So it seems that they were saying that lucid dreaming could be prescribed to people who are having recurrent nightmares as a way to actively integrate those nightmare aspects, to confront the nightmare. Because, of course, if you become lucid during a nightmare, you have the possibility for conflict resolution and psychological integration, which will lead to the cessation of those nightmares. So actually, there's a new movement starting at the end of 2009 in which lucid dreaming is being taken much more seriously as a way to help treat nightmares and psychological disorders. Now, this moves on to shadow integration, because one of the easiest ways to apply shadow integration, in my view, is through lucid dreaming. So what is the shadow? In fact, I chose this subject quite off the cuff, but I realized there's actually an institute to Jung down the road, so this room is probably full of these amazing Jungian analysis, and I'm trying to talk about the shadow here, so please yell out if I'm talking rubbish. But the shadow is a Jungian concept used to describe the parts of the unconscious mind which are made up of all the undesirable aspects of our psyches, which we have unconsciously rejected, disowned, and denied. The shadow is our dark side, but a side of ourselves on which Jung himself commented that in spite of its function as a reservoir for human darkness, or perhaps because of this, the shadow is the seat of all creativity. So it is within that dark side, within that disowned aspect of ourselves, that lives the potential for full creativity. And of course, what could be more creative than a lucid dream? To be within a three-dimensional projection of your own mind's creation, fully aware that that is what it is, and with practice, full volitional control over that dreamscape, with the ability to influence it at will. So shadow integration is about the assimilation of these rejected shadow aspects into the wholeness of the self, leading to what Jung termed individuation, or full psychological completeness. Now, shadow integration isn't something that's just practiced in lucid dreaming. Of course, shadow integration is practiced in waking therapy, Jungian therapy, and of course in non-lucid dreams as well. I was speaking to someone last night who was actually, as she nursed her baby, She was telling me about how she has these dreams in which she's shooting people and killing them. And this lady is a wonderful, compassionate, you know, Buddhist practitioner of a woman. And she has all these dreams in which she's shooting people. And I thought, that's a perfect example of shadow integration. Is that the shadow is coming up. It wants to be known. It wants to make itself heard. And it's not that she's a psychopath and she wants to run around shooting people. But it's that perhaps there's an imbalance there in the psyche, which the shadow and the unconscious is looking to address through these non-lucid dreams. Now, of course, the great thing about lucid dreaming is that if those shadow aspects crop up, you can, with full reflective consciousness, engage them and aim to assimilate them. So in lucid dreams, the way that shadow integration works is that whenever you encounter a frightening, perverted, violent, or distasteful dream character or dream scenario, you should actively embrace them, fearless in the knowledge that they are you, part of the mental projection that makes up the aspects of your own psyche and dream. So in a lucid dream, when these things come up, rather than turning our back on them, or attacking them, or fighting them, or willing them away, which we can actually easily do through sustained lucid dreaming practice, we turn to face them and engage them. To face that dark side and engage in that pool of creativity. Shadow aspects can be as obvious as a kind of a demonic character charging towards you with an axe, or as subtle as a really annoying dream character. Now, a lot of people don't think about that. They think about the shadow aspects in dreams have to be these kind of axe-wielding maniacs, or the part of yourself that shoots people, like the nursing mother. But in fact, shadow aspects can be just really annoying people. There's a great lady, Debbie Winterbourne, who runs the Academy of Dreams in London, where I've done some stuff. And she's got an exercise for finding your own shadow. And what she makes you do is write down all the things about other people that really annoy you. And so I start writing down, egotistical people, people who speak too loudly on the train, all this kind of stuff. I'm thinking, yeah, I'm doing this exercise really well. Of course, then she says, your shadow is on the page in front of you. It's all those things that annoy you about other people are actually usually the unconscious projection of your own shadow. And I see that in myself. Aspects that I've learned from my father or from early childhood and stuff like that, that I see playing out as the shadow. Now, the great thing is that while in waking state, I usually forget them. And I am that egotistical person who speaks too loudly on the train. In the lucid dream state, when these shadow aspects come up as symbolic representations, they're much more easily recognized. So usually in dreams, and in fact, usually in lucid dreams before we've had training in shadow integration, we run from our shadow aspects, fight them, or argue with them. So we either run the other way, we run towards them and try and destroy them, or we engage them in debate, but argumentative debate. But in lucid dreaming, the aim is to remain fully lucid, fearless and patient as you embrace them with the compassionate realization that they are merely constructs of your own mind, which you now have the amazingly valuable opportunity to integrate into a state of full psychological wholeness, or as Jung termed, individuation. So I just want to give an example of a shadow dream that actually contains, it doesn't contain Rob, but Rob's in the story. Is that a couple of years ago, when I first got asked to start doing this lucid dreaming teaching by Lama Yeshe Rinpoche, I got this kind of authorization to teach, which is... I'll give you this amusing story about it. You get this authorization to teach, which is where the Lama kind of gives you the seal of approval and says, you know, you can teach in Buddhist centers kind of thing. And I went into this interview with him, and we talked about several things. And then he said, in this beautiful broken Tibetan English, he said, Charlie, some people have a lot of knowledge. And I kind of went, yeah, that's me, a lot of knowledge. He went, you? No knowledge. And I went, oh, great. But you can really do this practice. That's good. So anyway, I'd had this authorization. And so I started to really practice the lucid dreaming. I thought, right, I can't let Rob down. I can't let Lama Yeshe down. You know, I'm probably far too young. I'm sure they've made a mistake somewhere down the line, but I'm going to work with it. I'm going to try my best. So I was really hammering the lucid dreaming and the dream yoga practices, really going to depth. A lot of the dream yoga practices are when you engage in spiritual practice within the lucid dream state. So once you're lucid, you might choose to engage a certain meditation or sadhana or practice within the dream state. So I was doing a lot of this. And I'd be sitting there doing my practice, meditating in the lucid dream state. And then this kind of presence of doom would come. Just this, I don't know if anyone's had a panic attack, but that feeling just before a panic attack of just dread, just something bad is going to happen. And that feeling would come. And this voice over, I mean, it's a dream, so it's disembodied, just the voice coming over the dream intercom or whatever, was mocking me and saying, you're an idiot, you can't do this, you don't know what you're doing, let alone teach it, you should stop this rubbish, blah, 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 blah. All it's saying these horrible things. And sometimes it would embody this kind of demon aspect. And I'd be sitting there doing my meditation, and then with full lucidity, I'd kind of transform myself into this Buddha, and I'd make swords come out of my arms, I'd charge at this demon, start chopping its head off, blah, blah. And then I'm very ego proud. Like, oh, great, I killed that demon. And so a couple of months later, I met up with Rob in London, and I proudly told him this. I went, oh, you know those nightmare aspects I've been having during my dream yoga? Yeah, I figured it all out now. I just transform into a kind of Manjushri figure, and I chop their heads off, blah, blah, blah. And kind of waited for a response, and just like Lama Yeshe, again, very deflated, Rob just looked at me and went, no, 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 no. I would advise, actually I'll do a Zetan, I would advise doing precisely the opposite of what you've been doing, Charlie. And I said, well, what do you mean? He went, embrace the shadow. And I thought, okay. So again, I'm young and naive, so when Rob says embrace the shadow, I take it very literally. So the next time, a couple of weeks later, I'm doing my dream yoga thing, and this thing comes up again, and it's embodied. Classic kind of archetypal demon, you know, big thing with horns just charging towards me, weapons hanging off it, kind of like one of these wrathful things that you get in Tibetan Buddhism, and that charges towards me, and this one's so scary, I just run the other way. I'm like, no way. So I'm legging it the other way, and I start to remember Rob's advice. I'm thinking, no, Rob said face it, Rob said embrace the shadow. So I turn around, and I'm running towards the thing, reality checking the whole way, which, by the way, is a way you can tell if you're lucid dreaming or not. And I'm running towards this thing, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to attack it. I know what Rob said, but this one's too scary. And I'm running towards it, and I think, come on, Charlie, it's just a dream. There's no way you can be harmed. Give it a shot. Do what Rob says. Embrace the shadow. So I run up to this thing, and I just go, bam, and I bear hug it. And this thing's huge, and it's muscly, and it's trying to escape, and it's like that. And I think, no, just hang on. Embrace the shadow. Embrace the shadow. So I've got this grip around it, and I'm just thinking, you know, happy thoughts, thinking, this is, I know you're part of myself. I know you're part of myself. I'm feeling compassion. All this, you know, all this rubbish that I'm trying to do, going through the motions, but completely scared in my mind. And I suddenly feel it shrinking. And it's shrinking, and it's shrinking, and it's shrinking. And I'm thinking, something's changing here. Something's changing. Something's changing. And I'm like that. And I release the embrace, and it's myself. Direct mirror copy of myself. And as I release the embrace, this version of myself just looks at me with a half smile and goes, and then walks off the other way. Now, I have no concrete evidence that I assimilated a rejected shadow aspect, a phobia, a fear, a perversion into the wholeness of myself. But what I do know is the next day I had something that a lot of these lucid dreaming books talk about, which I've never really bought into, which is that they all say after a great lucid dream you'll be buzzing for the whole next day, or you'll feel like you're on cloud nine, all this stuff. I've never really had that. I mean, of course, when you lucid dream, there's a great sense of achievement because it can take a while to get to your first lucid dream. But I've never felt that. But after this dream, the next day I was buzzing. I mean, I really felt just spontaneously happy. To a, you know, a remarkable degree. And also, most notably, that shadow aspect never returned. Sure, I've had nightmares since, I've had shadow dreams since, but that specific aspect that would mock me, this kind of mocking, doom, panic attack presence, has never returned. And that was about a year or so ago. So that's my subjective evidence. Of course, the thing about lucid dreaming is even though you hook people up to these EEG machines and these magnetic resonant imaging machines and stuff, it is still subjective. But what I do know is that people who have engaged in the shadow integration have all come back with the same thing, that they have felt that something shifted, that they had felt that just for a minute they became their own therapist within their own mind, a remarkable and astonishing feat. So comparatively, most lucid dreams are actually far more positive experiences than non-lucid dreams. It was perfect, actually, that Dion read out that list of you know, the most popular dreams. They're all fleeing or fighting or all kind of negatives. Whereas actually, if you do the same research on lucid dreamers, the majority of lucid dreams are overwhelmingly positive. Of course, these shadow aspects come up, but on scale, on a relative scale, lucid dreams are usually very positive. Now, this may be because the part of the brains that deals with fear and emotion is not as dominant in lucid dreams as it is in non-lucid dreams. Or it may be because the dreamer's knowledge that what they're experiencing is just a dream negates the disturbing power of any negative aspects. So I'm not sure which it is, but usually lucid dreams are overwhelmingly positive. However, shadow aspects can and often do appear in lucid dreams with high frequency. Now, this is confusing to a lot of people, because when they first get into lucid dreaming, they start having these dreams and they fly about and they, you know, they're having a great time. And then after a few months, they start to get all this shadow stuff. And it's very interesting because Jung's got another theory on this, which is the theory of compensation. Now, Jung described the compensation theory as an inherent self-regulation in the psychic apparatus, which aims for harmonious balance within the psyche, of the dark with the light. So it seems that if we engage in periods of sustained lucid dreaming, where through our volitional control, in inverted commas, because I don't feel we ever have full control, with our volitional influence over the dreamscape, we can choose to dream about fluffy bunnies and meeting movie stars and meditating and all this stuff. But that can sometimes upset the balance, and that the shadow will rear its head looking for this compensation, looking for this balance in the psychic apparatus. So lucid dreams offer great opportunities for shadow integration, and nightmares even more so. So although the techniques given for engaging lucid dreams we haven't discussed today, I hope that it's become clear that through learning how to lucid dream, or if not lucid dreaming, then just bringing more consciousness into the dream state, we can learn to be aware of the other aspects of ourselves, of the dark side, of the shadow side, of that pool of creativity, and learn, as Shakespeare said in The Tempest, that we can acknowledge this thing of darkness as mine. Thank you very much.
Over to you.